Hello, everybody. Welcome to News for the Soul. This is Daniel Brinkley.
This is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. We know that we choose to come to this world, and we're chosen to come to this world, and we've come for breath. We breathe in for ourselves and out for spiritual unfoldment. And as we breathe these moments, let's open up our heart and open up our souls, and let the true awareness of News for the Soul make its impact now and forever.
Good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you're listening. I'm Nicole Whitney, and it's News for the Soul time. That's life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained, and I've tracked him down, and he's back on the show today. I was going through Satyan with Raja withdrawal. It's been too long. He traipsed off on a spiritual quest in India with his group from Warrior Sage, and he's back to tell the tales today. Welcome back, Satyan.
Oh, thank you for having me once again.
I've missed you terribly.
I always feel at home when you're chatting with me and I'm with your News for the Soul folks. I just feel right at home. So
this is a home. I'm glad you think of it that way because it feels very much that way. And I was thinking of you when you were on your trip. I thought, oh, my gosh, I know amazing things are happening to them over there.
Well, you know, there's a few times where you came up in my consciousness very distinctly. And
I literally felt like I was just there with you in some form sometimes, so that's kind of interesting.
Well, we were invoking your spirit at certain, you know, parts, certain very unique parts, and which I'm sure I'll share with you as we get along.
I figured it was easier than sticking myself into your luggage, so. So why the trip? Why going to India? What was the purpose of the trip?
Well, first of all, my, you know, national origins are Indian. My parents are of Indian nationality. I'm raised in Canada, but I have deep Indian roots, and that's what my name comes from, is an Indian name. And I've always had an affinity with the spiritual tradition of India, and not just the spiritual tradition, but growing up in an Indian household, seeing my mother and father every day have a prayer routine, a meditation routine in the morning, ever since I was a kid. No matter what they did, and no matter what was going on in our personal lives, my father's business life up and down, whatever craziness was happening, without fail, for really 40 years, I saw every single morning my parents have a practice, a spiritual practice that they do from their heart. It's not just a ritual. They do from their heart. And this really inspired me as a kid. I sort of dropped the ritualistic component of it, but I really tuned into the devotional aspect of it. And it was a dream a few years ago to take people to India to show them the inner India, the spiritual India, the profound India. I mean, India is a huge place. There's a billion people. And this, I mean, one could go literally, you know, hundreds of times to India and not even see a bit of India. That's how profound and deep and wide India is. Yet I really wanted to go with a group of people who would appreciate the spiritual nature, and so we organized it through Warrior Sage, and we all embarked together, and there was 48 of us, believe it or not, which is one of the most largest trips ever as an organized group. And
that's huge.
Yeah. So we have the most.
When did you go? You left in January.
That's right. That's right. And I was there for a month, and my group was with me for about 2 weeks, and some people stayed longer. And we started our profound divine adventure into, really, whenever we're adventuring, we're not adventuring on the surface of the planet. The planet, in truth, is really within our own being, our own consciousness. And so when people say, you know, where did you go? Ultimately, every place that I'm going to is finding another corridor, another door, another place within my own self. And that was the approach that we all took, that when we go to India, we're going to be seeing all types of things, you know. Because it can be a bit scary, the idea of going to India, because there's a lot of rumors of how, you know, it's just so intense and poverty and dirty. And you know what? The truth is, that's all there, for sure. There's poverty there. There's pollution there in ways that we can't even imagine. You know, we're from Western Canada, which is so fresh. British Columbia is so alive and air is so good. And the minute you land in India, it's not that way. And
well,
how do you open through it was our biggest lesson.
Walk us through that. I mean, what way is it?
Well, so we landed in India. And, I mean, I've been a few times, but this time there was it's much more cleaned up. It's much more catered to the Western world now. They've put a lot of money into tourism, infrastructure. India's booming as an economy by itself. I mean, it's just booming. A lot of people predict that it's going to be one of the, in the next 20 years, probably one of the world's top superpowers in terms of economic power, simply because it's a billion people, and there's a huge push for all of them to align themselves around having a successful economic base, you know? 1 billion people. So we got there, and there's this, it's interesting, there's this, although there's this cacophony of cars and, you know, goats and cows that are crossing the street, and, you know, when I say a lot of people, I mean a lot of people, thousands and thousands crossing the street here and there. You have to have a sense of peripheral vision that's so aware, yet you have to be so relaxed to move through the place. So an example, let me give you a real life example. If you're crossing the street, you just look at the other side, and when you're ready to go, you go. You don't change your pace of walking. If you do, you throw all the drivers and everyone on the street off. They're sensing that you're moving at that pace, so they're going to react and move in accordance to the pace that everyone else is moving. But if you're stopping and going because you're nervous that you're going to get hit or you're waiting for cars to go by, it actually causes more trouble. So I can see why a billion people have so much faith in God. You have no choice to have faith in God when you live in India. The very fact that you're not dead at the end of every day by driving means that there's a divine power that you tap into, you know?
Wow.
I'm saying it in a humorous way, but it's so true, you know?
So also, you're suggesting then that they've heightened their sixth sense or another sense to kind of move collectively without speaking.
Totally. I was there for a month, and most of us were there for at least 2 weeks. So rare did we see any type of strife between people, like overtly. So rare. I think once or twice I saw people bump into each other or auto rickshaw hit someone else lightly, like another car, and just so lightly. And it wasn't a big storm between the drivers, but it was, you know, a bit of angst. And could you imagine that? Out of all, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of people that I saw cross my vision, right? That the strife level was so low and blew my doors. There's an inner calmness in the Indian consciousness, a sense of going with the flow, a sense of going with the river, not resisting what is, a sense of moving along the lines of least resistance, going with the flow of things, rather than trying to navigate with your mind. There's a navigation that happens. And I'm talking right now regarding travel, walking, driving, rickshaws.
Way through it.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
So many of my students, when we came back, they said that's one of the most powerful lessons that they got, was learning how not to resist the flow, but how to find your way, your uniqueness, not losing one's uniqueness, but finding your uniqueness in the current of life. And that's a gift India gives you, just by being there. You don't even have to talk about it. If you start to surrender to the cacophony and find out, you know what, there's a mystical, profound, delightful flow in the midst of this so-called chaos. There's nothing chaotic about India, although it may seem like it at first glance.
It's hard to probably really get without actually being there, but
yeah.
We can try. Because it's hard to imagine that many people in that region.
Yeah. Well, just wait till I tell you about the little later on when we got to the Kumbh Mela. And I'll get to that as we go progress, which for me was one of the highlights.
Okay, so you've made it to the airport. You've landed. What's the first thing that hits you?
Again, we were at nighttime. We came in, it was nighttime. And the quietness in the street. There's still a lot of people moving around, but they're not talking. There's an inner silence. It's not like people are trying to fill the space up with conversation, you know? It happens when it happens. And when it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. So there's a beauty in that. And obviously, we stayed in very beautiful locations like our hotels, and some of them were palaces. And the locations we stayed in were really, you know, very beautiful and posh. And this was to give everyone the sense of a safety and a replenishment. But at the same time, in my teaching, I talk about learning to master the opposites. If you feel that money is bad, then on some level, you'll be stuck in a poverty rut. And if you feel that that poverty is bad, then somehow you'll be also creating that in some way. Anything you resist, some part of your consciousness will allow it to arise as a repetitive thing for you to learn how to dissolve the attachment or the, you know, abhorrence you have of it, you know? And so what I do in my work is I have people go into the most intense poverty, experience that, what people are like in that realm, feel what it's like to be in opulence, and feel the experience of that, and then ultimately to let go of it all and to move towards what your deepest core yearns for in your own heart. I don't really believe, you know, there's a lot of teachings out there about becoming a millionaire and all of these things. I really don't feel we all need to become millionaires to be happy. For some people that may be great, and for some people that may drive them. But this drive and push to be always rich and rich and rich, you have to first be rich in the heart, the soul, the simplicity of life.
Well, I'm more purpose-driven.
Yeah.
That's always struck me as being very empty for a goal.
Yeah. Then we went to, as we moved along our journey, some of the highlights that stood up. One of the first ones was Mathura. And Mathura is the legendary birthplace of Lord Krishna in India. Krishna represents a being of divine, considered an avatar, meaning a divine incarnation of God. And this was the mythical birthplace we went. And because my family grew up in a Hindu tradition, and I grew up, and my father and mother were, you know, followers of Krishna, this was especially like a childhood experience. It was a very warm and loving experience for me. And we all came to this small little temple that's been there for who knows how many thousand years. And we all, you know, crowded inside it. And there's these two old ladies who didn't speak any English at all, who saw the devotion and the reverence of all these Westerners, you know. We had people from the United States, from Canada, in my group, about half and half. And they saw the reverence and the attitude and the love that we all had. And, you know, a lot of us were not, many of us almost had any type of Hindu background, But we all came as spiritual offerers. You know, we were offering our heart to India and receiving its gifts. We came with no preconceived idea, you know. And they felt that. And they didn't speak English, but they, at the end when we all came out, they wept with us. They were just blessing us with such sweetness, and they felt like we were their children of these two ladies. And they just, they must have been, in, you know, 70 years old or something like that, and to be received without any English, to be blessed by them and to be cuddled and loved and to feel that they, and I could understand because my native language, Indian language, is called Gujarati. It's a provincial language of Western India. My Hindi is what they were speaking, and I'm not that good at Hindi, but I can pick up bits of it, right? And what I found was what they were saying was so sweet, and I mean, it's like meeting your grandma, and it's like total strangers. You know what? That's how it was with every elderly person that we came across. They treated like all of us as their children, their grandchildren, their family. And this is one of the other profound, forget the mystical aspects of India, one of the most beautiful things is to be received as an actual family member by thousands of people every day. Every day. They were so joyous that we were interested in their country. They thought, why would you be interested in our country? You've got so much in your country, you know, from what they watch on TV and their ideas of America being paved with gold, you know? And it was to feel that family bonding with strangers. Some of us felt more close to strangers within minutes, that we were treated more like family. It's bizarre, like in the West, the way we treat family for a lot of us, for in their way of being, is how we would treat a guest or a distant guest. Someone you don't know that well, but you're being cordial with, you know? And the way they treat the most cordial of distant guests, well, many of them, not all of them, many of them, was like your immediate family member.
Oh.
That was just so heartwarming over and over and over again, you know? And, you know, you got to remember, many Caucasian members of our group, African-American, black, you know? And it didn't matter. Because, I mean, we stood out like a sore thumb, right? Just looking different, first of all, right? Over the color of our skin is just different. And yet, the moment we made eye contact with them, and they felt us, some kids, children, teenagers, shopkeepers, adults, elderly people, there was a feeling of this rich smile that would open up in their eyes, feeling that, wow, we've come as honored family to see their beautiful country, you know?
And this was consistent wherever you went.
Wherever we went.
So, I mean, you'd go into a lot of Western societies of strangers making eye contact with people, and they'd be calling the authorities. I mean, why is it so different?
You know, there's such an... Well, first of all, if you close yourself off to others in India, you're just going to perish. The fact that there's just so many, they're used to it, right? That, like, for example, a shopkeeper, I don't call him sir. We don't really, there's no, it's like uncle, if he's older than me, like the age of my father or someone. Or I would say, you know, auntie, uncle and auntie. In my language, and in the Indian language, there's very few words that describe even cousin. We don't even have the word cousin in Gujarati. It's sister or brother. So that means anyone who's of my father's, you know, who's what we would call in the West a cousin, in India it's your brother or sister, just as close as your actual blood brother or sister. We don't have a saying of second or third cousin. We don't even have that saying.
Actually, sort of live that proverbial, we're all...
A family in a very tangible real way. Now, you know, I'm painting a beautiful picture, and, you know, like anything, there's always two sides of a coin, right? There's also sometimes there's less autonomy or independence allowed. Let me give you a real example. You know, it was really funny. My wife and I was invited by my aunt to look for this jewelry, you know? She wanted to buy my wife, Suzanne, some jewelry as a gift, you know? And reluctantly, we said, okay. So we ended up in this shopkeeper's place, and this beautiful older lady showed us all, you know, my wife, all this jewelry. I was sitting there twiddling my thumbs, right? Because that's not an area of my expertise, you know. And what happened was all my other cousins and my aunts, when they were looking for themselves too, but they don't buy anything right away. They all converse amongst themselves for hours around the smallest trinket. It's rare that, like, a cousin will go and buy a piece of jewelry for themselves, by themselves, because they felt like it. There's a communal sense of buying even a car or a jewelry, the fruit of, you know, maybe what fruits are going to, or what foods they're going to make that day. There's a communal sense of choosing together. Now, that what I found at first was quite restrictive. Because I'm used to, you know, if you like it, Suzanne, that's my wife's name, Suzanne, go ahead and buy it, right?
And quickly, get it over with.
Yeah.
That'd make me nuts.
And then what happened was, you know, the jewelry was taken home. The lady said, you know what, you take it home, wear it for a couple of days, check it out.
Wow.
Do it and then get the, you know, and then if your uncles and aunts like it, then you can, you know, just let me know and just send me the money. You don't even have to come back. I'll send my boy to pick up the money.
That, I mean, wow, that's absolutely hard to conceive of running business like that. And but, you know, it's sort of, so you're kind of describing it as it's happened, like sort of out of do or die.
Well, you know, it's part of the world that they live in, and it's family is so everything there. And I think that's one of the big lessons we can take back and that I took back is to make sure that I nourish the legs of my family, you know, my father, my mother, and my brother. And it doesn't sound metaphysical, but you know what? You can't have metaphysical. I believe a lot of people try to seek metaphysical solutions when the basics are wonky or not solid, you know? And so we don't have to be blood brother and sister. We can look out for each other, you know? We can make ourselves family for each other. And we don't have to do it in huge ways. You know, we could do it in small ways. The other day, helping each other out, supporting each other. If one feels down, the other one calls up. If one is losing motivation in a goal they went for, your friend calls you up. And you know, you treat each other as family. Growing up, you're collectively evolving each other.
But why do you think we need to be reminded of this in the Western culture?
Well, you know, if you look at our TV, our everything is becoming so and more separative. Our TV is basically makes us, most of the shows make us really into idiots. I'm sorry to put it that way, but it's idiotic. There's no depth of consciousness. It's so rare. It's all about killing, murder, separation, abuse, death, danger, sickness, and fear. And even the comedy is so shallow, it doesn't touch our soul. And so when we don't have in our entertainment, we started that way, but the family structure is eroding here. And unfortunately, I have to say, you know, people feel it's happening in India too, but what they call an eroded family, it blows my doors because to me it seems so deep, you know. But
well, give us an example of that. What do they call, what would be eroded for them?
Well, just even the fact that, you know, the very fact that some family members live in another side of the country, you know, like they've chosen or for work reasons. In the old days, they wouldn't. They would stay within the same town to support each other.
And for us, that's quite normal.
It's an everyday occurrence, you know. There's pros and cons, but ultimately, I think the biggest lesson I learned in all of us came away is that, you know, we're a family now. I mean, all of us who went together, we're a family. It's just done. We love each other as family. We sat on buses and airplanes and rides and camels and looking through things, and we've become a really a family of spirit. And regardless of our nationalities or backgrounds or ideological differences, when you just love and you share food with each other, you know, and you feed each other and you look after each other, when someone's got a bellyache and 5-10 people take care of that person because they ate something off, and this good old-fashioned humanity is what makes us family. And India was certainly a catalyst to take us into that realm deeper than we ever have, you know.
Wonderful. Well, now, after this first visit, the temple.
Yeah. Well, the, let me tell you another profound place that, you know, I can't put it in order because the order sort of is not in my consciousness. It was so mystical and magical. They're more like points along a journey, you know.
But non-linear tour.
Yeah, it really felt non-linear. The other amazing place that stood out was one of the most sacred places of all of India, called Varanasi, also known as Banaras in the old days. In the British rule, it was called Banaras. And in ancient days, called Kashi, K-A-S-H-I or K-A-S-I, Kashi. But Varanasi is what it's called now. And it is a place where at least 5,000-6,000 years spiritual tradition and practice have been going on. It's a holy city which Lord Shiva created. And Shiva in India is another incarnation of the Great Spirit. And Shiva represents the master meditator, or the most enlightened meditator, you know, or the dance of dissolving, the one that is dissolving illusion so that truth can emerge. That's Shiva. And this city people yearn to die in India in this city. They say if you die in this city, and that you will have a higher birth in the next life. Or for some people, for many, that they will release themselves from the ongoing cycle of birth and death. So it's a very mystical city. There's all many sadhus, which are like wandering mendicants, wandering holy men, you know, all over the place. And there's this holy river that flows through it called Ganga, the Ganga River, also known as the Ganges. I don't like to call it the Ganges because that's sort of a funny British term for I don't know why someone couldn't call it Ganga. It's not that difficult to say, but it's called the Ganga. And the Ganga River is a ceremonial place where people come and they bathe. And they do a ceremonial ritual of cleansing themselves, their physical bodies, their mental body, their emotional body, other spiritual bodies, so that they're not just cleansing physically, but they're rejuvenating their whole body, mind, and spirit, you know? It's like, in the Western tradition, going to Lourdes in France is like a ceremonial bath in the waters that bring and open the divinity within us, you know, same type of idea. So this has been going on there for thousands of years, and they have this ghat. Ghat means at the bank of the river, a special location where they do the cremation of bodies. In India, in Hinduism, we don't bury the body in Hinduism. In Hinduism, they burn the body, except for very special occasions, for the specific examples where you don't. But for most occasions, people are cremated. Now, we saw this at the banks of the river on a boat. We all got on these boats that were being oared by, two oarsmen. And we went by the sacred place where this fire, I have to tell you the story, it's so beautiful. It's on the banks of this river, these ancient temples, okay? Now, there's a fire which the legend is that Shiva created. And it's in a pit. And there's a family who's been caretakers or custodians of that fire for time immemorial. They can't even trace it. Now, that family is considered, in ancient India, they had caste system of different castes. They had the priestly caste, then they had the warrior class, which is below them. Then they had the merchants or shopkeeper class. Then they had the lowest, or what they called the working or the untouchable class. This was outlawed because, for good reasons. It started off with some logic to it, but over the years, through power and corruption, it was turned into a more of a control mechanism, you know? Unfortunately, this has happened all around the world in caste systems, you know, where it starts off as a good idea to help segregate people for their capacities, but something like that can be so abused and corrupted. Well, that's what happened. But somehow some wisdom came into this, because the Brahmin or any other class, the only way that you can have a funeral pyre be ignited, like, you know, the wood that's on top of, that's below your body, the only way that you can get that ignited is you have to ask permission to get the flame from the Shiva flame, right? Now, the Shiva flame is owned or is in custody of the lowest class family. What that means is that on your way out in death, even the most highest king or rich man or priest has to bow down to the lowest caste person to ask permission and pay them whatever this family asks them, whatever it is, or you don't get the flame to burn the. It's a final evening out. Do you get what I'm saying? It's like a balancing. It's like, I don't care how rich you've been in life, at death, you're just as equal as the lowest caste.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so these people who were custodians of the fire of Shiva, now this flame has been ongoing, they've estimated at least 2,000 years in the same pit. So 24 hours, there's people there keeping the wood alive who are priests and ritual masters of this, right? Well, we found them through this back roads of this small town, Varanasi. When I mean a back road, I mean one arm length wide. That's it. And, you know, cows and dogs and people, you know, thousands of people walking through these tight streets. Well, we came across the fire. This actual, where the original flame is of Shiva. And with reverence, I mean, they were shooing us away, but with reverence, I asked, can you please give me some of the sacred ash? Because ash in India is considered sacred. They call it vibhuti, the ash of this flame, this wooden fire, Shiva's fire. Well, they packed it up for us in a little package, the sacred ash, and we brought it back home. It has supposedly, miracle qualities, medicinal qualities, and transformational qualities. Well, we're going to put that into the new building. We're going to put that into the mortar of the new building that we're making at our mystery school.
Wow. That's amazing, and that's amazing they gave it to you. I mean, do they do that now and then for people, or is it kind
of... They look into your eyes. If they feel that you are in reverence, yes. If they feel that it's just some tourism thing that you're on, you know, I'd like a bit of your sacred ash, please, then they just shoo you off. But if they feel that you're in sync with the harmony of where they're coming from and coming with reverence, then by all means, they're...
And they're not abusing the integrity of it, of selling it in little packages or something. It's a real honor given thing.
That's right. And, you know, if you want to leave, you know, in India, there's a whole system of it's not tipping, but it's like donation, you know. You offer, because these people only live off donation, right? So you can donate if you want, you know. But it's not like a forced thing.
And this flame, it's like the original flame you're suggesting.
It was supposedly started by Lord Shiva himself.
But someone has kept it going for thousands of years?
Well, at least 2,000 that they can estimate.
Wow.
Non-stop.
And what are the mystical properties of it then?
Well, it's known for healing the ash, okay? Clarity of mind. People just take it or they rub it on their body. Sadhus will sometimes rub it on their body as a way to show that they're more closer to death. The burning ash is what's left over when you're dead, right? when after you've been cremated, your body turns into ash. It lets us know that our whole body and everything will eventually turn into ash. And so it's a reminder of our mortality. And it reminds us to be really full and alive in every moment. So although Shiva represents, for some people, the destroyer, that which is dissolving illusion, it also, when you dissolve illusion, you actually become very alive, become profoundly alive.
And why is it then that people only can be cremated with that flame? Like, I mean, don't people...
Not everyone does. I'm saying this is reserved for people who obviously, first of all, the truth is the average person, the amount of wood that it takes, I can't remember how much they told me, but they told me it's a lot. To burn one body is a lot. And so this is the ancient tradition. Now there's a billion people, so very few people can afford even just to die their last few days in Varanasi. You know, they're all over the place. In India, there's so many sacred rituals. You don't have to go anywhere. In your backyard, you can do a sacred ritual. That's the beauty of Hinduism, is that you can have your own temple in your own house with a little altar, and you never, ever have to see it go to a church or go to anywhere. The whole idea is that a temple is anywhere you create it. And so anything is considered sacred the moment you sanctify it in India. So if you have a... if you put a little rock in the corner of a room and you put a little flower next to it, that to you is your temple if that's what you want to make it. And all you have to do is find your own relationship with the divine in your own unique way. That's the beauty of the roots of Hinduism. It allows you to have a relationship with the divine in any way you want. Now, some people, through this tradition, they do this in Varanasi, but it's not necessary by any means, you know.
Deep, the mystical aspects of India. Where did you go next?
Let me tell you.
In a non-linear way.
Okay, I'm going to give you the highlight now. I think I'm ready for it.
Okay.
Okay. The highlight was this event called the Kumbh Mela. K-U-M-B-H. M-E-L-A. Kumbh Mela. Now, the legend of the Kumbh Mela was in an ancient Indian tale of the gods in the heavens, okay? Very simple story. I'm going to simplify it, that they were churning the ocean of immortality and drops fell onto the earth plane, you know, from this immortal realm, the celestial realm. And where one of the drops, one of the three main drops that fell of this ancient elixir, from the divine realm, and one of the places it dropped was where we were in Allahabad. It's a town, a city in India called Allahabad. So it's a very sacred place, and it's where these different rivers come together, different holy rivers of India, Ganga being one of them. Well, every few years, they do a celebration there, a mela, a gathering, a festival, okay? And a sacred festival. And you won't believe it. Everyone listening? 30 million people, they estimate, were at this one. Let me say that again. 30 million people in one place coming from all over India to celebrate devotion, God, love, truth, in whatever way that they could do it. If it was a simple man in his own simple way of approaching the absolute God, from philosophers to very high holy men. And our guide had arranged for us, it was a mystical thing, that we had to leave very early in the morning from our hotel to walk to this place around 4 a.m. The reason is because we were trying to coincide with the first procession of, it was a holy day, January 19th, a very special day astrologically according to Vedic Hinduism or Vedic astrology in the Indian system. And on that day, at a very specific time, based on the astrological signs, the first people that are allowed to bathe in the water are these naked sadhus. A sadhu is a naked holy man. We've seen pictures on TV and so forth of these fellows in funny postures with long hair with gray ash all over their bodies, sometimes doing very intense yogic, modifications and doing, strange and wacky things, Well, the lowest, meaning the ones that have the least, the ones who have given up everything, they don't even have clothing, they are considered the kings of the day. Because they are the ones who have the least, they've renounced the most in terms of materialistic renunciation. They become the kings of the day. So they are the ones who get honored by allowing themselves to bathe and to dunk themselves in the holy place first before anyone. So our group left in the early morning walking through a mass of people. Imagine millions of people at 4 a.m., pitch black at night, almost no sound, pure calmness, 48 of us walking amongst millions of people in calmness towards this festival with not a ripple. The guards, the police, the organization of the Indian government was unbelievable. It was profound. All the guards were very calm, no pushing around, no boisterousness, no power tripping,
Wow.
It felt like, to control 30 million people, that's the population of Canada in one location. That's a few square miles wide. Now, when we all started getting to the location when the sun was just breaking, coming out, right? And then we climbed up this hill, and lo and behold, I oversaw one of the most incredible scenes I've ever seen in my life. And that was a sea of humanity that was so wide and full and electric and so full of devotion. I froze, and I not only did my eyes weep, it felt like my soul was weeping in joy. I could not believe it. I was seeing millions of people in front of me, all there for the same reason, and that was to celebrate God.
And this happens how often?
Well, there's the big one that happens every 12 years or so, which is 70 to 100 million people.
That wasn't the big one?
No, this was the smaller one, which happens every about 6 years, which is only a paltry 30 million.
Man.
So we went there, we came, and by magic, our guide, his name is Karampal Singh, he's a master. He's actually an awakened being. He came with us. I have a knack and a penchant of attracting and finding the most amazingly awakened beings. You've been around and you've seen how that happens.
It's a gift. Well, I've seen it.
That's what happened. Well, he was our guide, and he's an awakened master, actually. And he had this ability to just point and open the sea of people with his intentionality. So imagine 48 of us trying to get to the bank of a river, moving through about 5 million people, 3 million people at least. Okay? Well, it happened within minutes. Minutes! Meaning, how could it have happened? It was like Moses parting the sea. That's what it felt like.
Wow.
Got to the front, and we missed because of the... We missed the first dunk of the naked Babas, but we saw the procession of all these other saints and holy men who have all... and gurus. And, hundreds of them, right? And then... we were so blown. By this time now, it's about 9 in the morning. We've already had a full day, right? Waking up at, 3 o'clock or something. We've already had a full day. Some of us went back to rest, and we went back to rest after just wandering and seeing the sights and meeting with people. And then some of us took a dunk in the river, which was just incredible. And then, are you ready now for the big finale? Then we went to... Some of us wanted to go back at nighttime to see. They have these things called the akadas. And akadas are these tents. When I mean tents, some are small, but some are huge tents, okay? Huge. And these are all different saints, gurus, spiritual teachers, holy men, renunciates, sadhus, fakirs. Fakir meaning wandering mendicants, people who have no attachment to anything, you know? People drunk with God, you name it, you know? There's thousands of them there, thousands of these people there, okay? And they all have their own tents, so you are welcome to go visit them. Now, in the row of all the tents, the first tent is the Naga Babas. Naga means naked Babas, or the naked holy ones, okay? One of my guides, he said, go check that out first, you know? So I took a group, there's about 15 of us. We went to the first tent. Now, when you see the tents, the rows of them, it's intimidating. Because I knew that was our, we only had one night there, right? I figured on my mind, I went, I'd like to get to as many as I can, right? But, you know, you could spend 2 months there and you would see 1 or 2% of the place. I'm not kidding. That's how many people are there.
Even the numbers you're seeing.
It's unbelievable, okay? Well, we went into the very first akada, or tent, large tent, the very first in all the rows, okay? But they're the Nagabawas, so no one is allowed in. It's not a welcome tent, okay? They're very mysterious and very private, these Nagabawas. And according to Hindu law and Indian law, they actually have guard. They have like guards, like Nagabawa guards, who are warrior monks. Okay, and they have these swords and these tridents, which are sharp. Okay, if by Indian law they can actually kill a person and never have to go to jail.
Oh, nice.
They're trusted so deeply for their impeccability that if anyone gets killed by their hand, nothing can come to them because they are protected. They are considered so holy that they would not do anything like that. Imagine that. That's quite intimidating, right? Anyways, people from a distance we saw, and we saw that many Indians came by. They did a bow of reverence outside of the tent, left a donation and walked on. And these guards would shoo people on, like, come quick, you know, do your prayer, give your reverence, and then go. Because you have to keep shooing people off. If you keep them there, there's just too many people crowd around, right? And they're private. They don't want to be stared at in a certain way, too. Because they're in a different world, you know? Well, anyways, you know me, right? I'm a bit adventurous and a bit crazy. So I walk right up to the two guards who are sitting down. Two other ones who were sitting down near the front of the gate of the place, right? I sat down in reverence. I opened my heart. I looked in their eyes. And the one who looked at me, after about half a minute, he started laughing. And he slapped me on the head, right? And he said, come on in. It's in Hindi, right? And he invited my whole group in.
Wow.
With open arms, jolly. And I was like stunned, and everyone's scared because they look a bit intimidating, right? And I just quietly looked at everyone and turned my head over my shoulder and said, come with me now. So we walked in and he pointed us to this other master Baba who came and with his beautiful arm invited us in. And he said, come. And just with hand gestures, come around him. And we all sat down with all his other students and Babas, right? And they started making tea for us. And they started handing us tea. And then he started speaking with me. Now, his English wasn't great, but it was actually pretty good, you know? And me and him connected on such a profound level, non-verbally. And he was one of the most beautiful men. This man could have had any woman he wanted. He was like his beauty as a man, you know, like he was so handsome, you know. But he had no attachment. He gave everything up. And his eyes were on fire with such beauty and depth and light. And I just merged. We just merged. And then they offered us their sacred sacraments. And they have different sacraments that they do there, different mystical teacher plants that they partake of, and different mystical sacraments that they have. And for them to offer that to us is such a high blessing that even the other Babas around, some of the younger ones, were wondering, why is our teacher being so nice to these guys? But they include us in. Then, after a while, a younger Baba, probably, 39 or 40, looks at me, and I just go over to him, and it turns out he's been sitting there in silence. His English is really good. And he looked at me, and he says, and after a while, he started chuckling because he recognized, he says, "You Western Baba, coming to East," you know. So then they gave us their greeting of, in India, we say namaste when we meet other people many times. Namaste or namaskar. Also, northern parts, Sikh people say, Sasayakahal. There's different greetings in India, okay? But they're mostly about the divine in me acknowledges and sees the divine in you. But these Babas have their own greeting. They don't say namaste. They say Om Namo Narayan. And they were teaching us this chant so that they were accepting us as Western Babas, Western spiritual practitioners visiting their home. That was the way we were. So they saw us as them. Then I have to tell you what happened. I know we only have a short time left, but this is the creme de la creme. The young man, after a few minutes, after recognizing us and giving us this love and this welcome as Western Baba, all of a sudden everything went telepathic, meaning me, him, and many of the other Babas and few of our students all started communicating in a realm which is beyond words. It was tangible, and we saw it happening amongst each other. Simultaneous connections and conversations beyond the verbal realm. And his master gave him like a key to this young Baba. It was like an energetic key. And then the Baba looks at me and he goes, "You wish to meet other Babas?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Please stand." And I motion all my whole group to stand. He kicks back the back flap of the tent. We go through it, and there's a secret huge corridor like of hundreds of tents of all these Babas, and they all have their own fire, right? It's at nighttime now. There's no Indians, no Westerners, no one, just them. And he took us for the rest of the night through a tour of the mystical back scenes of the Kumbh Mela, which no one sees.
Oh, my God.
And then he says, "You wish to photograph, videotape?" And my student, I had a student who had a video in the photo. He goes, "Oh, yes, please." He goes, "You may, but for no commercial use." Meaning you can't, he doesn't want it to be sold.
Right.
But it wasn't him speaking. He was channeling his teacher, you see. He was getting the insight, the awareness from his teacher of where to go. So this lone Baba walked alone, but 15 of us went behind following him. And he through the night, he showed us and he introduced us to different masters of different realms. One was a tea Baba, Kali Yuga tea Baba, who only drinks tea. And he was a character like a out of a Alice in Wonderland, like unbelievable. And then after we had our, and he taught us about gratitude in his very Zen-like way, and money and manifestation. And he has nothing. He long story short, he kept asking us for donations, which was like almost irritating, right? And the moment we gave it to him, he took the money and he ran to these other Babas and gave it all away.
That's funny.
Isn't it funny? He wouldn't keep anything. He was trying to show us how flow happens, the board, you know?
You've ended at a very high point here. We're at the top of the hour. This is going to make me nuts. You absolutely have to come back very, very soon and continue this.
The last person he met, he showed us, he says, "You want to meet our master?" I said, "Yes." There's only a few of us left at that time. We came and we were graced to meet the headmaster, a 113-year-old yogi, been practicing for 100 years, profound meditations. His eyes were on flame fire, his ears were totally, and he started channeling through me and an old lady. His words started coming through us to our group. And he showed us the most simplest thing. My wife, Suzanne, was blown open in tears. He was so much love for us was coming through him. It was hard to look in his eyes. It felt like one would dissolve and blow up from the force of love. That's how profound it was.
How soon can you come back, Satyan?
I'm well. Anytime you'd like. And I know we have to complete, but I just want everyone to know that India is the empire of the soul. And if any of you ever have an opportunity or a desire, you're evoked by this, by all means, you're welcome to come with me or go on your own. But do make a trip to find out the inner India, which is already in your soul, but it certainly helps touching the motherland of the spirit. You know?
I want to go with you. It sounds like a good...
2008 is our next time.
Okay, well, stay on the line, Satya, and let's get you booked for another show so we can, because we're going to be getting mail now going, my God, what happened next? So, absolutely amazing. I knew it was going to be, and this is why we wanted to talk today, and I'm so glad that you were here and that you're you and you're doing what you're doing in the world. Thank you so much, Satya.
Thank you.
WarriorsH.com is where you go to find Satyan, and highly recommend it. It's got amazing programs and workshops and stuff on the go, plus these amazing, as you've now heard, spiritual treks around.
And you know what? We've got a whole new set of introductory free workshops that my staff are going to be conducting, my top trainers.
Oh, great.
And they can find that out by going to WarriorsH.com and click on where it says Sex, Passion, and Enlightenment, and they can find out all the details and or just call our number at the office that you'll find on the website, and we'll take good care of you.
Okay, indeed they will, warriorsh.com. Thank you so much, Satyan, for being here today.
Thank you so much.
We'll get you back on soon.
Namaste to everyone, meaning that the divinity within me recognizes, acknowledges, and loves the divinity in you.
You mean we need to call you Bubba Satyan now?
The nickname they gave me was Bridge Baba, meaning the bridge of the east and the west, the north and south, the up and down. So,
Bridge Baba.
Affectionately call me Bridge Baba.
Love it. Thank you, Bridge Baba Satyan, for being here.
Thank you.
Satyan Raj is online, warriorsh.com. We're back on Monday. See you then, everybody. In the meantime, by the way, newsforthesoul.com, all free, all the time, as always. See you there.
This has been News for the Soul with Nicole Whitney. Visit us anytime online at www.newsforthesoul.com, where you can listen to all our previously aired shows at any time and so much more. Have a great week, and remember, what you focus on expands.